If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Now 1 p.m.
Use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
President Trump swings into the swing state of Pennsylvania today to address the economic anxieties of Americans.
For Tuesday, December 9th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump's tariffs have hit American farmers hard.
We'll hear their reaction to the president's offer to help this week.
It's meaningful. I'm not going to say it's not meaningful, but is the quantity going to alleviate all the farmers' concerns? I don't think so.
Also, teenagers in Boulder, Colorado are learning how to help build affordable houses.
It's not like we're building a little mini project. It's real world type stuff.
And scholars set out to make the world's first dictionary of ancient Celtic words. I might even try to pronounce some.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. economy headlines President Trump's visit today to a swing congressional district in Pennsylvania. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, President Trump's holding a campaign-style rally in Mount Pocono at a time when polling data suggests waning trust in his response to affordability concerns ahead of next year's midterms.
In his second term, President Trump has done very little domestic travel aimed at pitching his policies to the American people. In fact, he's done way more travel to sporting events than going out in the country and making his case. A senior White House official I spoke with, who was not authorized to speak publicly, readily acknowledged that this sort of messaging travel has been lacking and said the president would be ramping it up late this year and into next year, starting with today's trip to Pennsylvania, which is to a competitive congressional district.
NPR's Tamara Keith. London Mayor Sadiq Khan is reacting to a podcast interview in which Trump insults him and several other foreign leaders. NPR's Lauren Frayer reports.
President Trump said this to Politico about London Mayor Sadiq Khan.
He's a horrible mayor. He's an incompetent mayor, but he's a horrible, vicious, disgusting mayor. I think he's done a terrible job.
And he went on to say that Khan, a popular center-left politician who is of Pakistani descent, owes his election victories to the rising number of immigrants here in London. Khan, in turn, told Politico that Americans are actually flocking to London, in part because of its liberal values that are the antithesis of Trump's. He said the U.S. president, who has insulted him in the past many times, seems to be obsessed, and he doesn't know why. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
The U.S. Department of Education says it has reached a proposed settlement agreement with the state of Missouri to end a popular yet controversial binary student loan repayment plan. The agreement, assuming it's approved by the judge, would allow the department to move the more than 7 million borrowers still enrolled in SAVE to other repayment plans. An environmental group wants a national moratorium on the construction of some new data centers that power artificial intelligence. More than 230 groups have signed on to a letter to Congress. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
The group Food and Water Watch drafted the letter, citing the risk of higher utility bills and environmental concerns. Mitch Jones with Food and Water Watch says a pause is needed so regulation can catch up.
And let's figure out if it's possible to do this in a way that is going to be safe for the environment, that is going to preserve water for communities, that is not going to drive up people's already increasing electricity prices.
The industry group Data Center Coalition said in a statement that halting construction would jeopardize digital infrastructure that's essential to contemporary life. The coalition argues a moratorium would risk U.S. economic competitiveness and national security. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
The Dow closed down 180 points. It's NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. More than a week after a mass shooting at a child's birthday party in Stockton, authorities say they're looking for multiple suspects but have not made any arrests. San Joaquin Sheriff Patrick Wilthrow says more than 50 shots were fired at the scene and at least 5 guns were fired.
I'm asking the public to be patient. I know this is going to be difficult, but this is not going to be in a week or two. We've got an answer and we start arresting people. You have to know that. Okay, this is going to take months.
The sheriff told the San Joaquin County Board of Supervisors this morning that the initial scene was so chaotic, deputies were initially sent to the wrong location. Three children and a 21-year-old were killed in the November 29th shooting. 13 others were injured. California data centers are being built in communities already burdened by environmental hazards. That's according to a new report out today. KQED climate reporter Laura Clivens has more.
Data centers are essential to powering the AI boom. The report found the centers are often sited in areas with unhealthy air, limited groundwater, and high levels of hazardous waste. It highlights existing and planned data centers in San Francisco's Bayview-Hunters Point neighborhood. Lily Genghis is with the CAPR Foundation, which authored the study.
There's a lot of disparities already in health factors, environmental factors that cannot be ignored.
The report says the centers can add air pollution, use large amounts of water, and leak hazardous waste. Both Bayview Hunters Point data centers did not respond to requests for comment. I'm Laura Clivens, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Afternoon support comes from San Francisco Bay University, providing education to prepare students for an AI-driven economy. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with a goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. And the listeners of KQED. Support for KQED also comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Life has gotten very expensive for Americans. Food prices, utility bills, healthcare costs. So it is no surprise that affordability is becoming a campaign centerpiece for Democrats and Republicans as we start looking ahead to next year's midterms. President Trump is in the most important swing state in the country, Pennsylvania, today, to try to take those issues head on. But this is a topic that in recent weeks, the president has struggled to address.
Use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
Trump is in Monroe County, a place in northeastern Pennsylvania that backed President Biden in 2020, then swung to Trump in the 2024 election. So how are swing voters in a swing state feeling about all of this? We called up Christopher Bork, professor of political science at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
You are the person to call when we want to know about public opinion in Pennsylvania. So let's start with kind of the basic numbers that you are seeing. How are Pennsylvanians feeling about the economy? How are they feeling about President Trump?
Yeah, not surprisingly, Scott, they mirror lots of what we see nationally. Pennsylvanians are not in a good mood regarding the economy, the direction of the nation as a whole. And that's reflected in their appraisals of President Trump. His job approval numbers are in the low 40s, which again mirror what's happening nationally. It's not the same environment that he found just a year ago in the Commonwealth when he was able to carry the state for the second out of three attempts here.
In terms of the numbers you're seeing, approval ratings, things like that, how much has changed or how little has changed over the past 12 months?
Well, as you know very well, Pennsylvania is a state that's always on the margin when it comes to presidential elections, and often just the smallest changes are really impactful. And so last year when the president carried Pennsylvania, he did so by, you know, a little over a point, almost 2 points. And therefore his margin of error, if you will, in terms of staying above water isn't that great. Mm-hmm. And so if you lose even 5 to 10% of the voters in the state, it's significant. And if you look at where his polls are now compared to where they were a year ago, there has been loss. And most of that loss is in terms of his handling of areas that were once a strength.
Yeah.
And those strengths are economic matters, where he's seen the biggest decline in terms of how the public views him.
He, just like Joe Biden before him, would blame the economy on Donald Trump. Trump is regularly blaming the economy on Joe Biden. We are a year into this administration. Do you have any sense from what you're seeing and hearing of the limits of that kind of message?
I think it's very limited, Scott, the ability to really convince people a year in almost to his administration that this is largely the impact of the cards that he was dealt when he came into office. I think the president's got a really difficult time making that case. It's going up against what people feel and Pennsylvanians feel. And right now they don't feel good. They don't feel good about lots of things. They don't feel good about electricity prices. They don't feel good about housing prices in the area. They certainly don't feel good about healthcare. And while the president can craft a message that targets the Biden era impacts, I think it's not necessarily reaching the audience in a way that's mattering for him.
You know, it's such a static political country. You talk about the fact that Pennsylvania is always on the margins, but it's a state that went for Trump, went against Trump, went for Trump again. What is the best way to think about the voters who've gone back and forth and what draws their attention, what turns them off, what wins their support?
Yeah, Scott, it's a group that I think is longing for something and not always easily defined. As you said, they've vacillated now in Pennsylvania and places like Monroe County, Northampton County, the eastern side of the state, over the last three elections. And I think they're searching for something that's not necessarily always easily attainable. Mm-hmm. And right now, who's ever in power seems to be paying a price for that longing. It's hard to make a case, right? It's hard to make a case to voters who aren't happy that you are really doing a good job. Biden struggled, Trump struggled before him, and now Trump is struggling again. It's a big challenge to convince unhappy voters that you're doing a job that's, you know, serving their best interest.
That's Christopher Borick, professor of political science at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, also the director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
Affordable housing and a shortage of skilled workers are big challenges across the country. A school district in Boulder, Colorado has formed a partnership with the city and Habitat for Humanity to teach kids trades by building homes that working people can afford. Sam Fuqua reports.
We're inside a 32,000 square foot factory where modular homes are in various stages of construction. High school teacher Darren Rasmussen and student June Baker huddle over blueprints, figuring out what went wrong with the drywall installation.
When he said it was way too small, wall A.
Well, it was like 5 of 10. We have one wall A that's right and then one that's not built because I had to take it apart. But I've learned my mistake, and then they realized from that mistake that they need to start labeling each wall with numbers.
Bye. Ready up there?
The city of Boulder built this $13 million factory on land owned by the Boulder Valley School District, with help from state, federal, and private foundation grants and loans. And it pays for the materials used to build the houses. Students get hands-on experience building homes and course credit. The local Habitat for Humanity chapter manages the program. All the groups involved say the three-way partnership is the first of its kind in the nation. In November, they trucked their first two homes a few miles away to the Ponderosa Mobile Home Park, where they were hoisted by crane onto foundations. High school senior Sean McCormick was helping out.
I think it was a big accomplishment for us and what we can do in the future and all the problem solving we had to do. Because it's not like we're building a little mini project, it's real world type stuff.
McCormick plans to go to trade school to become an electrician or pipe fitter. The industry group American Institute of Constructors estimates the U.S. will need more than 500,000 workers to keep up with demand. After this mobile home park flooded, the city bought it, fixed problems, and began working with Habitat for Humanity on upgrading the housing. Dan McCauley is CEO of Flatirons Habitat for Humanity.
So the families who are getting houses here have been living in substandard housing, some of them for decades.
Residents have the option of staying in their mobile home or buying one of these new modular houses.
All of these families will have a mortgage. The mortgage is based on their ability to pay and their income, so there is a significant subsidy involved.
The three-bed, two-bath homes are 1,150 square feet. McCauley estimates costs will range between $350,000 and $450,000. The median price of a single-family home in Boulder last year was over $1.3 million. Maribel Gonzalez-Rodriguez is one of the new homeowners. She lives in a small, older mobile home just steps away from her new house. She'll move into it soon.
Me siento muy emocionada porque
Nos están dando la oportunidad de tener nuestra propia casa en nuestro mismo lugar de...
She says it's incredibly exciting that she gets to have her own house. Her trailer right now is two bedrooms and there's not a lot of space. She's a single mom with four kids. They share the bedrooms. Maribel sleeps on the couch. She's lived in Boulder almost 25 years and works in the kitchen of a downtown hotel.
Y lo que me gusta es que no me voy a mover de Boulder y tengo el área más, la vista más bonita de...
She'll have her own upstairs bedroom with, she says, the prettiest view in Boulder. For NPR News, I'm Sam Fuqua.
Our next story has big golden retriever energy, and by that I mean 2,397 golden retrievers, and they're humans, converging at a park in Buenos Aires, Argentina on Monday morning to set a new unofficial world record for the most golden retrievers in one spot.
That's right. The idea came from a 10-year-old golden named Ollie. More precisely, the idea came from a 28-year-old man named Fausto Dupare. That's him hyping the event on social media. Dupare is an actor, a cafe owner, and a self-described pet-friendly content creator. He and his friend Flavia Fittipaldi have coordinated other gatherings of dogs before, but this one was, of course, way bigger.
A few years ago, Dupare went to an event in Barcelona in Spain that gathered 150 goldens. He and Fittipaldi decided to look up where else this had happened.
Vancouver held, in the past, the largest amount of golden retrievers gathered in one event. It was around 1,600.
She says when they talked to the Argentine government about trying to permit a world record attempt, officials were all about it.
They said that as long as we left everything in perfect conditions, there was nothing to be done. It was just go and enjoy.
Now, gathering thousands of families and their pepperonis from across the country meant finding pet-friendly places for them to stay overnight. That was another big task to coordinate.
People volunteer like, I have a house, come with your dogs, how many are you, stay with me. So that was really nice.
Fittipaldi says there's something special about golden retrievers, that they're iconic for a reason.
They are just big dogs and hairy, but they are eternal kids. That's what you sense from them. They just want to play all the time. They are happy, upbeat. They like getting into pools and swimming with golden retrievers. It's just beautiful to see.
The AP reported you could hear these 2,000-plus dogs barking from miles away.
And from the looks of the photos, everybody was such a good doggy. But we all know photos sometimes lie.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from John Muir Health, delivering cardiac surgery with a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health. PG&E, if customers see a down power line, stay away from it, keep others away. Call 911. Let first responders come out and handle it. Police and fire will respond as well as PG&E. PGE.com/safety.
Clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine at kqed.org.
You ever wonder where all the hundreds of billions of dollars are coming from that are funding this AI boom?
I don't even think Americans are necessarily unfamiliar with this concept. We might have even heard of it previously as a shadow bank.
I'm Kai Rizdal, paying the tab on AI. Next time on Marketplace.
Another edition of Financial Stories on Marketplace, first up at 4 this afternoon, and an update at 6:30 p.m. on KQED News today and early this evening.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, severe threats to federal funding for programs aimed at helping the homeless are causing near panic in California, which stands to lose hundreds of millions of dollars if the cuts go through. Experts say the cuts would reverse progress made, getting the most vulnerable people off the streets and into permanent housing. It's Political Breakdown on KQED News at 5:50 today and wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And the listeners and sustaining members of KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. There are more than 500,000 words in the Oxford English Dictionary. Some trace their origin as far back as the 11th century. For centuries, linguists and academics have kept careful track of those words and their origins, but not every language gets cataloged in the same way. Take, for example, ancient Celtic. Those are early languages used by the peoples of the British Isles thousands of years ago, and some of those words can be found in modern Irish and Welsh. Simon Rodway is a professor at Aberystwyth University on the west coast of Wales. He's trying to put together the surviving pieces of this language. He and his colleague recently set out to make the world's first dictionary of ancient Celtic words. Welcome, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my goodness, thanks for being with us. Okay, so as we said, there are about 500,000 words in the Oxford English Dictionary. How many words are in the dictionary that you are making?
Well, we're still at an early stage, but I mean, I'd say we've probably got over 1,000, but we're not going to get many more than that because the records of the Celtic languages in Britain and Ireland are not great.
You say about 1,000 words of ancient Celtic, but is that like a very small proportion of what you suspect is the total amount of words that were used in history?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's just a tiny little glimpse into the language. I mean, we're particularly looking at the ancient Celtic languages spoken in Britain and Ireland. Of course, they were spoken on the continent of Europe as well, over a great swathe of the continent of Europe, in fact. That kind of helps us because we can see similarities and differences. And in the Roman period, when most of Britain is part of the Roman Empire, the Romans were very literate. They wrote everything down. They were hugely bureaucratic. So we have a lot of letters. We've got legal stuff. We've got
Thank God for bureaucracy sometimes.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, they were using Latin, which is the official language of the Roman Empire, but they were recording place names. They got into Latin.
And can you talk about these texts a little more, these texts that are primarily in Latin, but where you find the occasional ancient Celtic word embedded in it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've got quite a few of these, mostly written in Latin, but they've got Celtic names and so on. And what's really interesting, really exciting, is we've got a very small number. We're literally talking about 4 or 5 texts that are written entirely in Celtic. And most of these are curse tablets.
Curse tablets?
That's
ancient
right.
Celtic curse tablets.
That's right. Ancient Celtic curse tablets.
What are these curses about?
Well, I mean, mostly they're curses against thieves who have stolen the belongings of people, particularly in Bath. In Bath, you've got some Roman baths. They're incredible. And people used to go there and bathe in the waters, which are naturally hot. So quite often, because it was kind of like a tourist attraction, there were thieves there. So people would take off the clothes and they get in the bath and they come out and they find that somebody had stolen their clothes.
I see.
What they do then is they would find somebody who had a sheet of lead and they'd scratch a curse on that lead tablet, asking a god or a goddess to do all sorts of horrible things to the person who'd taken their belongings. And they throw that into the spring, which was consecrated to the goddess.
Okay, so Simon, how do I say goodbye to you in ancient Celtic?
Goodbye. Well, I mean, we could perhaps hypothesize that ancient Briton speaking, the ancestor of Welsh, might say something like, in Welsh, one of the ways we say goodbye is
Yn Ya. Okay. Simon Rodway at Aberystwyth University, Yn Ya.
It was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. And you too.
Scientists are using artificial intelligence to help bionic limbs act more like natural ones. NPR's John Hamilton reports on an experimental hand that shares control with the user to carry out tricky tasks like holding up a styrofoam coffee cup.
The latest bionic hands can swivel, move individual fingers, and manipulate objects. They can also detect electrical signals coming from the muscles that used to control those actions. But Marshall Trout, a researcher at the University of Utah, says most prosthetic hands still aren't very smart.
The person has to sit there and really focus on what they're doing. They have to maintain, like, line of sight with whatever it is they're trying to handle, which is really not at all how an intact hand behaves.
Which is one reason that many people who get a fancy prosthetic hand stop using it. So Trout and a team of scientists set out to make a smarter prosthetic that would act more like a person's own hand.
I just know where my coffee cup is, and I can reach without having to pay too much attention. And as my hand gets closer, I can kind of feel where it is, and my hand will just naturally squeeze and make contact with it. And that's kind of what we wanted to try to recreate with this system.
The team turned to artificial intelligence to take on some of these subconscious functions. This meant detecting not just the signal coming from a muscle, but the intention behind it. For example, Trout says the AI control system learned to detect the tiniest twitch in a muscle that flexes the hand.
The moment we detect that small amount of flexion, that's when the machine controller kicks on, saying, oh, I'm trying to grasp something. I'm not just sitting still.
To make the approach work, the scientists modified a bionic hand by adding sensors that see and feel. That allowed the AI system to gauge the distance to an object and assess its shape. Meanwhile, pressure sensors on the fingertips told the user how firmly their prosthetic hand was holding the object. To test the system, Trout's team asked four people missing a natural hand to use the bionic version to drink from a cup, with and without help from AI.
With machine assistance, they could very reliably pick up these cups and mime drinking a sip of water out of the cup. And then without the machine assistance, the person just crushed it or dropped it every single time.
The results appear in the journal Nature Communications. And Jacob George, who oversaw the research at the Utah Neurorobotics Lab, says they address a problem that people often encounter when they use superhuman technology.
You can make a robotic hand that can do tasks better than a human user. But when you actually give that to someone, they don't like it. You know, they actually hate this.
Because they feel like it's not a part of them, and it's out of their control. George says this artificial intelligence system shares control with the user.
The machine is doing something, and the human is doing something, and we're combining those two together.
George says that's a critical step toward prosthetic limbs that feel like an extension of the person's own body.
Ultimately, when you create an embodied robotic hand, it becomes a part of that user's experience. It becomes a part of themselves and not just a tool.
One reason we feel that way about our own hands is that they're controlled in part by reflexes in the brainstem and spinal cord. John Downey of the University of Chicago, who was not involved in the study, says that means the thinking part of our brain doesn't have to worry about the details of every motion.
All of our motor control involves reflexes that are subconscious, and so providing robotic imitations of those reflex loops is going to be important.
But Downey says sometimes a human brain is needed to do things artificial intelligence still can't.
We can very finely manipulate things like putting a thread through needle and things like that, which take almost no force at all the way up to, you know,
grant.
We can very finely manipulate things like putting a thread through needle and things like that, which take almost no force at all the way up to, you know, grabbing a child and lifting them. The dynamic range on that is far beyond what robots typically handle.
For now, anyway. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and onstage blizzard runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org.
Iraq has been dealing with a severe drought for 7 years now. This year could be the country's driest in almost a century. Scientists say climate change is partially to blame, but there are many factors at play. That's next time on The World.
The latest global news on the way in 1/2 hour at 2 p.m. On the way, NPR News, more All Things Considered on KQED at 1:30.
All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Coming up, a program in Uganda that's trying to address poverty.
It gives people cash and coaches them to build income.
The big picture is about providing a faster on-ramp for households to be able to start up large and having a better and more stable source of income.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump remains bullish about the U.S. economy as more and more public polls show voters blame him for high prices and rising inflation. This comes 11 months into Trump's second term in office when he promised to fix the affordability issues. In this one-on-one with Politico, the reporter asked the president about the current state of the economy.
I wonder what grade you would give
A plus.
Economy. A plus.
Yeah, A plus, 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 plus.
Trump has called affordability a Democratic con job and a hoax, but recent layoffs and stubbornly high prices have left consumers feeling uneasy. Trump is holding a rally this afternoon in Pennsylvania to talk about the economy as his approval ratings have hit an all-time low and White House officials are asking voters for patience. Tax credits for people who are on affordable health care insurance policies will expire at the end of this month. Prices will skyrocket for many unless Congress extends those subsidies. NPR's Elena Moore has more.
The Senate is expected to vote on the Democrats' proposal later this week, which would extend these COVID-era health care subsidies for 3 more years. That plan doesn't have Republican buy-in. And though several GOP lawmakers are working on counterproposals that include things like income caps to qualify, the party hasn't united around one plan. Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley says it needs to.
What signal will it send if Republicans say, we're going to say no to the Democrats' plan, but we're not going to offer anything? Yeah. You know, the message that will send is, good luck to the American people, and we don't really care.
The existing tax credits currently benefit more than 20 million people across the country. Elena Moore, NPR News, The Capitol.
Not much of a change on Wall Street. Stocks remain mixed today ahead of the Fed's decision on interest rates. This is NPR. A police investigation in Britain has found the UK's security services hid the truth about a British army spy during the conflict in Northern Ireland. It was known as the Troubles. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab reports from London.
The double agent, whose code name was Steak Knife, was in an IRA unit which tortured and killed Irish Republicans suspected of being informants for the security forces. But he himself was working as a spy for the British Army. The report found that Britain's domestic spy agency MI5 was closely involved in handling Steak Knife, even though it had previously said it only had a peripheral role. The investigation also found that the double agent cost more lives than he saved and that he was implicated in very serious and unjustifiable criminality. Steak Knife, whose real name was Freddy Scapatici, was from Belfast and died in hiding in England in 2023. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
Well, members of the Federal Reserve are holding their last two-day policy meeting of the year in Washington, D.C. Investors appear confident the central bank will lower its benchmark interest rate tomorrow for a third time this year to keep a lid on inflation as well as rising unemployment. The markets will also be watching tomorrow for what the Fed says about additional rate cuts in the new year. You're listening to NPR News.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that.
This week on Close All Tabs, whatever happened to Purple Moon Games? Close All Tabs talks to the company's founder about its impact on girls in tech and how it all came to an abrupt end. Find that story in your podcast feed. Cloudy rest of the afternoon, some afternoon fog still. Sacramento Valley, a high of 45 this afternoon, down to 42 tonight. For the Bay Area, a mix of clouds and sun, highs in the 50s to the 60s this afternoon. Dense fog, cloud cover returning after midnight. Support for NPR comes from Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts like goats, chickens, or sheep to struggling families to help them create sustainable futures. Learn more at heifer.org/NPR. And the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump says that he is sending $12 billion in aid to American farmers who are reeling from global trade disruptions. Disruptions like inflation and Trump's tariffs, which are making fertilizer and farm equipment more expensive. Also, the president's trade war with China closed a huge market for American soybean exports. We're going to get the view now from the Midwest, and to do that, we're going to bring in NPR's Kirk Sigler, who's joining us from Mitchell, South Dakota. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so tell us a little bit about where you are right now and why that's such a good starting point for this whole story.
Well, I'm in the heart of row crop country. Think of soybeans, think of corn. Of course, I'm looking out the window right now. It's all covered in snow, bracing for another lot of wind and more blizzard-like conditions possibly tonight. But I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that Mitchell is home to the world's only corn palace.
Huh.
You could picture like a classic Midwest roadside attraction. But I mention this because it's symbolic of how farming literally touches every part of life and the economy here. And right now, I have to tell you, the mood continues to be one of anxiety.
Yeah, I imagine so. And just yesterday, the White House said that this $12 billion aid package for farmers is supposed to bridge the gap between President Biden's failures, that's how President Trump put it, and his successful policies, Trump's successful policies. So let me ask you, Kirk, is that how farmers are seeing it?
Well, that depends on who you ask. Conservative groups like the Farm Bureau are calling it an encouraging sign. Farmer unions, even here in red Trump states like South Dakota, say this bailout, as they say, was all preventable if President Trump hadn't started another trade war with China like he did in his first term. You know, this has led to China levying retaliatory tariffs, buying soybeans from Brazil instead, and longstanding export markets have really been closed to American farmers. So this $12 billion deal we're talking about isn't even as big as the 2019 aid package was, but generally, Elsa, I'd say farmers are relieved to see some money coming finally because, you know, this is when they're trying to get loans for next year, and if you've got a bunch of soybeans just sitting in storage bins not selling, it's pretty hard to prove to a bank that you're a viable business.
Exactly. Well, the Trump administration says it now does have commitments from China to keep buying millions of bushels of American soybeans, right? So are the farmers you're talking to selling their soybeans again?
Well, I'm hearing the exporting is starting to resume, but very slowly. You know, as for the trade deals, South Dakota farmers have been telling me they haven't seen anything on paper yet and are just working off promises by the administration. So today I met Kevin Deinert. We climbed up this narrow, slippery staircase to the top of his four-story high grain bin. Let's listen now as he opens the hatch here.
So I sorted everything I could, so it's full. As you can see, a little too full.
Right, so Deinert told me, yeah, exactly. Deinert told me he's been storing as many as he can, holding out for better prices in hopes that President Trump will ink better deals, but here we are almost at the end of the year.
I mean, how much longer can farmers wait at this point?
That's a great question. A lot of farmers I've been talking to throughout this year were already right on the margins. You know, they're still recovering from supply chain problems from the pandemic. You mentioned inflation, tariffs on fertilizer from Canada, to name a few things. You know, Deinert is 38. He's a fifth-generation farmer. He doesn't like the idea of another bailout, he told me today. He just wants to farm and make a living.
And, you know, as farmers, we want trade, not aid. It's meaningful. I'm not going to say it's not meaningful, but is the quantity going to alleviate all the farmers' concerns? I don't think so.
But, Kirk, is this aid package enough to keep farmers on board with President Trump, you think?
Well, this is a question that everybody's been asking, and I've been wondering for months now, talking to farmers and traveling around the country. Farmers are always reluctant to talk politics, but, you know, next year is the midterms. I'm talking to you from South Dakota. Mm-hmm. It's the home state of Senate Majority Leader John Thune. So there's a lot riding on whether these agreements, particularly with China, are going to hold.
Right.
You know, even if they do, farmers say it would really only bring us back to where the export market was a few years ago. And so I think a big question right now is, what was the point of all of this? But if Republicans want to maintain their majority, they're going to have to need farm country to stay on board.
That is NPR's Kirk Sigler. Thank you, Kirk.
You're welcome.
It's December, the time of the year where we think and talk and hear about nutcrackers more than any other time on the calendar. But the word nutcracker exists beyond the toy soldiers made famous in the holiday ballet. They've been used for centuries to, well, crack nuts. And the largest display of these devices in the U.S. is housed in a museum in Washington State. NPR's Vanessa Romo takes us inside.
Tucked into the Bavarian-esque town of Leavenworth, Washington, is a two-story jewel of whimsy and obsession. It's the Leavenworth Nutcracker Museum, which houses more than 9,000 handcrafted nutcrackers. And presiding over it all is
Arlene Wagner, and I am the curator of the museum, and I'm called the Nutcracker Lady.
Wagner is 4 feet 10 inches tall. She's got a halo of white hair. She wears her signature pearl necklace over a blue German dirndl dress. And yesterday, she celebrated her 101st birthday. She's an enthusiastic font of information on all things nutcrackers.
Nutcrackers are important because the nuts ripen in the fall. And so fall is when Grandma starts making pies for Christmas, and they need nuts shelled.
She's eager to show me around.
Come on over here, and we'll start here.
Inside, the museum is lined with floor-to-ceiling display cases, from 6 feet tall to mere inches, new and old. There are nutcrackers from 50 countries spanning centuries.
Well, first of all, there are several different kinds of nutcrackers. There's the lever, which has two handles, which can open the nut. There's the screw, which is done by a screw mechanism.
Wagner began the collection unintentionally in 1976. She was the director of a ballet company in Renton, Washington at the time, and was putting up a production of Pyotr Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker.
We were looking for the nutcracker for Clara to hold, and we found all of these big mouth, crunchy guys, and so we started collecting them.
What started out as a one-off acquisition snowballed into a legacy, she says. Soon, she began to collect them with her late husband, George Wagner.
We saw some, got introduced to the porcelain ones and the old metal ones. Oh, my goodness. We were so taken.
They devoted all of their free time to finding new items. Wagner jokes that she's never had a real vacation.
I have always said that someday I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to look at all the museums and things that you're supposed to look at instead of antique shows.
By 1995, they'd amassed a collection of 7,000, which became too unwieldy for any sort of home display, Wagner says. It was time to share it with the world.
That was the whole idea of starting the museum, was to let other people enjoy what we enjoy.
One of her favorites is a simple nutcracker from France made from boxwood. It depicts the bust of a man wearing what looks like a laurel wreath. Below the head is a date.
1554. It's the earliest dated nutcracker in the world.
These days, she works about 4 hours a day, and she's got a new nutcracker lady in training who's been by Wagner's side now for years. And she's still on the hunt for nutcrackers.
I might get a message today from somebody. I never know.
But there is one new item that's come in, a 10-inch hand-carved replica of the nutcracker lady herself. It was made by German artisans and sells for $150 in the gift shop. Cloud of white hair and pearl necklace included. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's the holidays, and for many people, that means more parties and more occasions for alcoholic drinks. NPR's Maria Godoy reports on how alcohol can hit harder as we get older.
Once upon a time, a drink or two went down the hatch with no problems. Now, it's a recipe for misery. Sound familiar? Dr. Monica Christmas of the University of Chicago Medicine says
It's a common lament as people enter middle age.
You are not alone. I am in that age range too, and absolutely it needs to be spread out or it's all going to go straight to my head and I will need to sleep half the day away the next day.
There are physiological explanations for why our ability to tolerate alcohol wanes with age. For one thing, the liver enzymes that break down alcohol become less efficient.
And so that means that our bodies metabolize alcohol a little bit differently. We also lose more muscle as we get older, and that muscle is replaced by fatty tissue.
That's important because muscle stores water, which dilutes alcohol in our blood. Having less muscle mass means alcohol will hang around in our bodies longer, says Johannes Truhl. He's an alcohol and substance abuse researcher at Johns Hopkins.
And so what this means is that the same drink that previously maybe felt just fine now leads to a higher blood alcohol level. You feel the effects for longer.
These changes happen to both men and women as they enter middle age. But for women in perimenopause, Christmas says alcohol can exacerbate the symptoms that come with hormonal fluctuations, like mood swings and irritability.
Alcohol is known to be a depressant. It can also increase baseline anxiety symptoms. Alcohol can disrupt sleep, too. If you're already experiencing all of those symptoms, it's just that much more compounded.
While worse hangovers might not sound like a good thing, think of it as your body nudging you in the right direction. Geriatrician Ken Concilia with the Cleveland Clinic says the risks of drinking alcohol increase with age.
Things like liver disease, increased risk of diabetes, high blood pressure very much can be exacerbated. Memory problems, alcohol use can cause dementia.
It can also interfere with many medications and lead to balance problems and more falls. And drinking alcohol raises the risk of several types of cancer. Concilia says he makes it a point to discuss the benefits of cutting back with his patients.
And these conversations about alcohol use, being proactive with people in their 50s and 60s, has huge impact for their health and well-being when they're in their 80s and 90s.
Johannes Truhl of Johns Hopkins says while the healthiest option is to not drink at all, even small changes to cut back can reap health benefits. During holiday parties, he says, try alternating alcoholic drinks with mocktails and drink plenty of water.
Why don't you just give it a try and see how it feels? Because you might be surprised how good it actually is when you sleep better, you have less anxiety the next day.
He says your body will thank you. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tuesday afternoon support for KQED comes from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com. Good Earth Natural Foods, serving the Marin community with organic holiday meals, turkeys, and more, with locations in Fairfax and Mill Valley. Now offering curbside pickup and delivery. Learn more at genatural.com.
In such a chaotic year, where did you find beauty? I'm Gabe Moline, editor for KQED's Arts and Culture Desk, and we've been looking back at uplifting moments from 2025. The kindness of strangers, a sweet rendezvous, the joys of community. We're calling it One Beautiful Thing, a series of essays about special, personal moments from the year. Find it online at kqed.org/arts.
Hamas says it is willing to lay down its weapons after 2 years of war in Gaza, but under what conditions? NPR spoke with two Hamas officials about that and about the group's decision to attack Israel 2 years ago on October 7th. That story and more tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition begins early tomorrow morning, 2 a.m. until 9 on KQED News for Wednesday. Then join us for Forum.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, the National Institutes of Health have historically funded scientists to find cures for diseases and protect public health. After a year of funding cuts and freezes that have rocked the medical research field to its core, we're going to catch up with leading researchers locally to talk about the impact this has had on their work and our ability to fight humanity's most puzzling illnesses. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. You need money to make money. We have all heard this before, but what are people living in extreme poverty supposed to do with that? How do they make it out of poverty? That is the problem for almost a billion people all around the world. And in response, some programs give people cash to start a business, and they coach people on how to build a sustainable income. But these efforts are dealing with some major global shocks. NPR's Fatma Tanis reports from Uganda on how these programs keep evolving.
Rolling hills are topped with lush greenery in this remote part of southwest Uganda. Most homes here are one-room huts with sheet metal roofs. 23-year-old Jacqueline Kabanyana and his family used to live in a hut like that. They fled here in 2018 from the war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But now, Kabanyana, the oldest son, is building a much larger and sturdier house. It's a big step up for this family of 11. They used to survive on just $5 a week. Sometimes they didn't eat, and they couldn't afford school fees for the children. Then, in 2022, Kabanyana got a grant for $74. He started raising and selling goats. This break came from a $28 million donation from the IKEA Foundation. 14,000 households in this region got the same grant. They can use it to start a steady business, like selling secondhand clothes or growing food. They also get coaching. It's called the graduation approach. Now Kabanyana earns $13 a week from raising goats. It's how he's built this new house. The people who got the grant meet up twice a month in groups of 20, along with a coach. This group meets at the school. In the middle of the circle, on the floor, is a metal box with some petty cash and a ledger. Today, there's other visitors, too.
My name is Dean Carlin. I'm a professor.
Economist Dean Carlin, who designed the program along with a team of researchers and the NGO that's running it, OVSI Foundation.
And so we want to learn as much as we can from what you've experienced so far.
Now, there are programs in many low-income countries that apply the graduation approach. But this one is trying something new. Carlin is an expert in poverty solutions at Northwestern University. And he's been wondering, could you get more out of the same pot of money? So instead of giving each household a one-time grant of, say, $200, a group of 20 households gets around $4,000 to manage jointly. They use the pot of money to loan themselves cash for their businesses. If those do well, they pay back the money and keep the profit. They also pay interest to the group on the loans, which then gets distributed to all 20 members. It's called the block grant, and Carlin says it essentially creates a mini bank for the group.
The big picture is about providing a faster on-ramp for households to be able to start up large and having a better and more stable source of income.
And funding for global development programs like this is being cut.
If we can find a better way of squeezing more juice out of whatever we're doing, then you can expand and help more people. And instead of going to 1,000 communities, we can go to 2,000 communities.
But in discussion after discussion, Carlin notices something perplexing. People have not been borrowing from the block grant as much as they could be. In fact, half of the money has been sitting safely in the bank. Carlin asks Kabanyana about his goat business. Why did he only take out 500,000 Ugandan shillings, about $140, from the block grant to buy two goats?
Why not have a budget for four goats and say my budget is $1 million and so that I can buy four goats?
He says, first, I wanted to see how the market is, and if I'm able to manage it, then I'll borrow more. Carlin then asks him how much he's planning to borrow next time, but it turns out it's even less, 300,000 shillings, about $80.
So I was surprised. Now he knows this is a successful business. He knows how to do it. So why is he borrowing less rather than more?
So me,
Kabanyana says, recently, I noticed that when I'm at the market, people have less money to spend. He's referring to the fact that many of the refugees here were getting cash aid to buy food, but the Trump administration cut that earlier this spring.
Because of the cutbacks in aid, there was less economic activity going on, the markets were not as thriving, and they could actually see that difference.
Other group members tell Carlin they're not taking out loans because they felt the bank was too far from where they lived. And one woman says she's afraid to take out too much. Her name is Antoinetta Justine. She points to the metal box on the floor. This money here, she says, it's where our hearts are. It feeds our families. That's why we're more responsible about it. OVSI's director of programs, Rita Larocque, chimes in, saying she appreciates that.
However, this money is supposed to help you make more money. Because when you borrow little, you earn little interest and you share little.
For Carlin, it's a stark reminder of how challenging it can be to address poverty.
What we're seeing today, clearly, from these conversations, is that it's deeper than you need money to make money. You also need to be able to take on risk to make money. And that's a double whammy for someone who's poor.
It can be really hard for people in poverty to take advantage of opportunities. There's fear that failure might leave you worse off than before. After all the meetings, Carlin and OVSI staff put their heads together. They decide to make some tweaks. Instead of a bank, they'll use mobile money online to help people access the block grant easily. And the coaches will have to keep encouraging the groups.
Over time, the block grant will get used more and more because of the group coming together and knowing each other better. And so that's one thing that we're going to look out for in the next phase of this project.
Back in the village, Carlin meets with a different group that shares a block grant. They gather under a gazebo surrounded by banana trees. This group's leader, Tumuriwe Justine, has a request for Carlin. OVSI's Ruth Ninsima is translating. She says Justine has been calling Carlin a jubu-jubu, which in Runyankore means the top leader.
She's referring to you as jubu-jubu, like high authority leader.
And what Justine wants Carlin to do is to get them a tractor to do more farming.
High authority, if you can get them a tractor, they'll be glad.
The leftover money in the block grant.
But Carlin says they don't need him to be the high authority to get that tractor. They can just buy it with the money they still haven't used that's sitting in the bank. Fatma Tanis, NPR News, in Southwest Uganda.
It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And your part-time controller specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And by the listeners, members, sustaining members of KQED. World with Global News coming up in just a minute on KQED News after Julie checks in with traffic in Orinda.
Looking at a solo spin-out on eastbound 24, it's before St. Stephen's Drive. I'll be in the right lane, starting to back things up to Camino Pablo. Road work is slowing things down out in Hercules and Highway 4 West between Willow and San Pablo Avenue. Striping work going on until 7 o'clock tonight. Got a crash in Cupertino on southbound 280 just after the 85 interchange. A couple vehicles not blocking now. They're both on the right shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Afternoon traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus's Holiday Spectacular, a concert series across the Bay Area blending festive classic